broadcasting from an undisclosed location, from a secret hunting spot known only to him and the guy who told him about it, and possibly the guy who told the guy who told him. It's a show all about hunting in New Zealand and around the globe. This is The Hunting Show. Find The Hunting Show on Facebook and Twitter for up-to-date information on upcoming shows and topics.
Welcome back to another week of The Hunting Show. I'm your host, Stephen Spargo. And I had quite a lot of feedback from our interview 2 weeks ago with Marama Fox from the New Zealand Maori Party about hunters, access and the treaty. Probably 80% of the feedback I had was positive, and most of the negative feedback that I got from you guys, particularly via Facebook, not so much by email, was actually people that hadn't listened to the interview. I really do encourage you to go back a couple of weeks, have a listen to that, and form an opinion based on what her and I talk about rather than the title of the show. I think you'll find it a little bit interesting, and the whole thing was certainly done in good spirits. On the show, I probably do 80% of my interviews by phone, so it's always a pleasure to be able to interview someone in person rather than getting on the end of a telephone. And this week's interview is with Murray Matuska, and he's certainly a local icon where I'm from in the central North Island. He's also a very keen hunter. He's got more stories than I know what to do with, and I hear a different one every time I catch up with him. And Murray, I've also now considered you probably in my group of friends as well, certainly a family friend. And on this very, very stunning February day, how are you, Murray?
Yeah, I'm good, Steve. How are you?
Can't complain, hey, I'm sitting here and you even shouted me a beer when I arrived. I can't complain at all. Murray, I suppose where to start with this is, how did it all begin for you? You've been hunting your entire life, I assume. And do you remember that first go, that first time?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I saw my first deer when I was about 14 years of age at place called Tierra, where I was growing up. I was going to high school there, and this guy had a hind in the paddock, a red hind, and she used to chase the hell out of everybody that used to, you know, it was opposite the hall, and all the young guys, including me, would get over the fence at night, and she'd chase us, but I tell you what, she was open for business too. And so then we left there, and we went to a place, my stepfather drew a farm at a place called Waikiri Valley, which is south of Rotorua, and when I got there, when I was 15 when I got there, and there was only 7 settlers in the valley, and the rest of it was all land survey stuff. And from the back of our place to Taupo, which if you've never been there, it's a long, long way. It was all fern, scrub and fern and everything. So I landed there, and it backed onto the Pyrrole Range, which is runs along between behind Reparoa and south of Rotorua there. And I was faced with an awe-inspiring situation, because everywhere I looked there was deer or deer sign and pigs. And so I was only 15, but I got a .22 rifle, which is sitting out on the Polaris there. You just saw it when you came in. And it's had 2 butts, but I've still got the action in the barrel, so it's been a wonderful little rifle. Single shot Lithgow it was. You remember those?
Yeah,
old Lithgow. Yeah, the old Lithgow, single shot. So that's all my stepfather would let me have. So that lasted for about 2 years, Steve, and then he said to me one day, oh look, he said, the deer have just chewed my swede paddock out up the back. He said, we better get you a bigger rifle. So he got me a .303, and which I still say, and I know you'll probably disagree with me, they were one of the finest rifles ever made. The old Lee Enfield's .303. The action alone was stunning. It really was, because it had that spring-loaded bolt that came up and sprung back, you know. And in those days, you needed 5 rounds or 10 rounds, didn't you? You needed 10 rounds in those days. And so anyway, that's how I started off, Steve. I shot my first deer with a .22, and since then, you would never know how many you've shot, but if you look around the shed, you'll see a lot of antlers in here, and all the ones I've kind of shot, and other ones that I'll explain to you about later. But so that's how I started off the deer hunting, and I've been kind of hooked ever since, because In those days, it was the only way you could go hunting was on a horse, or walk. And there was no such thing as helicopters, as you know. In the 50s, they were around, but not in the commercial thing. So anyway, we used to hunt on horses, and you know, I had horses, you could talk about horses for the rest of your life, but you could shoot off them, you know, and they never flinched. It was an amazing time of our lives, because you'd pack up on a Saturday morning. Oh, we went and played rugby, and the old story, you know, went and played rugby, and then you came home and jumped on your horse, and all Sunday, probably Saturday night, if there wasn't a dance on somewhere, and you were chasing girls, you'd go hunting, and every chance we got, we used to go hunting, and it was just a wonderful experience. A sheet of plastic and a hot water bottle full of water, because there wasn't much water up the fire horse, and a can of beans, and that would suffice for the weekend. And some of that plastic is probably still up there, and I do apologize for that. But anyway, and also the baked bean cans. But we had a wonderful time in those years, in the 50s, you know. I just can't. It's a whole book, Stephen, on the 50s. They were an amazing time of our life. Not only here, not only in Waikiki, but I never got to hunt the Kaimanawas until the early 70s, because I had too much to do up there. And down towards the Uwira country, or through Manganui, Te Whaiti, all through there, we hunted all through there, and we had a bloody ball. We did. But I guess that's in the past. But to appreciate the future, you got to look at the past. And that was how it was. It was fantastic.
I suppose you went on from that. Did you ever get into the sort of the meat hunting as well? Is that how? And I don't know your background with regards to meat hunting, but I have to say, where I work and through the show, I've talked to a lot of guys around during that meat hunting times. These guys, that's what they did for a full-time job. And I think guys my age who have never experienced that sit there and listen, and we absorb these stories like sponges because I don't think we're ever going to see anything quite like that again. But did you go on to do that? And how was that time in New Zealand history and for hunting in New Zealand?
Yeah, the meat hunting thing. Well, it started a wee bit before that, Steve, because when I got married in the late 50s to Barbara, who was still married after 57 years, she never stopped me from going hunting. The first thing I did was, deer skins were worth a lot of money. Deer skins were worth a lot of money. I think from memory they were up to £3, which £3 doesn't seem much now, nor to $6, but in those days when the wages were only £5 a week, it was a lot of money. And so I started off with this skin thing, and we shot a lot of deer and just left them laying there just for the skins. Some of those stag skins were pretty big, you know, but they were heavy also. But we pulled them out of the forest, and, you know, we did all that sort of stuff. So that's how I really started on the pay for what you shoot thing. And do you want me to talk about the meat hunting?
Yeah.
So anyway, then when we finally went through all the working period of our lives, and everywhere I've been, there's always been deer. We were shepherding on a place called Powhatan Station, which was north of here, which was a land and survey place. I think it was about 5,500 acres. I was a shepherd there, a lonely shepherd. And Barbara and I had our first, we spent our first years of our lives there. And that's when the skin thing was going good. And so that kind of helped us along. And we did that. And afterwards, we went share milking to get a few bucks to buy something like we have here today. And so from the cow shed, believe it or not, there was the Pyrrhal Range was right up in the distance, but with a good pair of binoculars, which were only cheap, $7.50, $11.50. Do they go as high as that? Yeah, they do. Well, it was the big ones. I bought the biggest ones I can find. That's been my problem in life. Everything I buy, I try and buy the biggest I can get. So anyway, I could see the deer from the cowshed up on the range of an evening. And I would be sitting there looking up, and Barb used to grizzle because when we're milking these cows, she had to finish up if I saw some deer. And I'd cut loose and drive around and climb the Pyrawas, which is 3,500 feet above sea level. It's a big row of hills if you look at it from the Waikiki side. And we'd shoot, me and a mate, we'd shoot two or three deer and take the skins back down, and that supplemented our income. So when we finally got to, we did a lot of things, Stephen. I managed, went back and managed that farm where I was first shepherding. And then we bought this place in Taupo, this 187 hectare place here in Taupo. And it had deer on the back of it. We backed onto 37,000 hectares of forest. And so we came here on a shoestring, as you probably did, and a lot of people do. And we came here on a shoestring. And so to supplement the income, I started this meat hunting thing. And with the sheep and cattle farming, you didn't have to, you don't have to go in to milk the cows or anything. So well, I had time. I did have time. And I poached a lot of deer out of Forest Products out the back here. And I think everybody else did too. But in my day, in the 70s when I came here, the hunting in Taharakuri, which has now been deforested and put into a dairy farm, which tears me apart every time I drive through it, the hunting in there was unbelievable. I got to know the forest ranger very well, and he was a great guy, and he loved his hunting also. And he'd bring all the stags he shot in the raw into my killing house and store them there until we could get them into town to sell them. But that's where we started the meat hunting thing. We hunted forever. We hunted down the desert road. We hunted in the Kaimanovas. We hunted in the Urawaras. We hunted everywhere just for the meat side of it. And but it wasn't an easy job, Steve, because you get a big stag. Big stag, say, let's assume he was 200 pound or 100 kilos, hanging up with the guts out. It was a big carry, you know. And I hear stories about guys picking up the whole stag and walking. I could never do that. They're a big animal, you know, 140 kilos, you know, and you not only had to take out the meat, that would have been easy. You had to take the heart, lungs, and liver too, and you had to take the head in the later stages, so they could test for tuberculosis. And but to carry a stag out of the forest or up a hill was a huge effort, and don't let anybody tell you that it wasn't. It's okay with the young hinds and spikers and that, you can manage with that. Even the spiker is a big animal. So I could never ever carry the whole thing, but I've heard stories about guys that did, but I could never do that. And so we used to cut them in half. I had an arrangement with the meatworks that they would take the hind quarters, and they were providing a strip down the back was taken off, so they could see that it wasn't the farm one or anything, and the ears, of course. But so that's how we did that. But no, it sounds good, all that sort of money. You were getting a dollar a pound, which was big money. I've got a bag of dockets in there you wouldn't believe, all the ones we've shot. Pigs also. And but no, it was a hard game. It was a tough game. And a lot of people walking around with crooked backs have that to remind them of those meat hunting days.
The meat, so it's the meat hunting side of things, you talk about the hard carries and everything, but it did, from what I can gather, and I'm only going on things I've read and things I've heard, it was pretty hard on the numbers. You know, near the end, before it was completely outruled, and I want to talk to you about that as well. They were getting pretty scarce from what I can gather, and particularly the helicopter hunting. Did you get involved with that at all?
Yeah, we kind of did all that sort of stuff. And when the helicopters came along, it was a whole new ball game, because, you know, deer, as we both know, love the open spaces. They love to be out in the open. And There hasn't been a huge number of big heads shot in the bush. The most of the big heads shot in New Zealand, as you know, you read those old books, are out on the tussock, aren't they? Where there appears to be nothing to eat. But that's what they like, because I've noticed on the deer farm here, Stephen, around the trees, there's clover up to your knees. Beautiful green clover. But the deer don't like it. They'll eat it if there's nothing else. But they do like the pasture where the sun's been on it. And so it's the same with deer. I've always found that the big heads are out in the open, not so much in the bush.
And with regards to numbers that you see in the hills, did you notice them dropping all the way off? I mean, we were just talking in the car just before that we're really I think we're seeing a real recovery finally. In some places it's gone too far and they need to look at managing that a little bit better. But was there an issue with numbers that it almost sort of ended in tears, or was it just that they were getting smarter? I don't know.
The area I used to hunt a lot was a bit north of here. In my day, you could see through 200 or 300 meters through the bush downhill. You could look down and you could see deer way down the bottom. Now you can't do that. And there was just too many deer. And so I guess the meat hunting to a degree helped. But we could only kind of go so far because you had to carry them. You couldn't get into the high country. So that was in the advent of the helicopters, that changed the rules, because as I said to you before, deer like to be out in the open. And the helicopters, well, they were just unbeatable. You cannot beat a helicopter. You can beat them out of the bush and that sort of stuff. I only ever shot one deer from a helicopter because I was involved at the time in the deer farming. And we were receiving live ones. But it must have been, when you look at it on videos of helicopter gunships, those guys were amazing, shooting with FNs and AK-47s, whatever they used in those days. And they could shoot them on the run, you know. I could never do that. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. But they did lower the numbers to a hell of a degree. But in the bush areas, where they couldn't get, I guess they had to rely on ground hunting. And that's when the colours came along. Well, the colours were there from the 30s, weren't they? But that did lower the population. And it worries me now to see the numbers building up to a degree where they're going to have to do something. Because with hunting, Stephen, as you know, a lot of guys leave the hinds. They say, oh, no, no, we don't want to shoot a hind. You've got to. Because, as you know, we have no predators. And we're the only predators that there is. And we have to go hunting. When I get the school kids here, I always say to them, hunting's a good thing because we have no predators. We're different to other countries. And that's why I'm not against 1080 to a degree, that 1080 takes you out 10% of your deer. We wouldn't probably be farming deer here if it wasn't for 1080. But I don't think it's done the deer, well, we know it hasn't done the deer any harm regarding population. And you don't seem to get the big stags, it'll get all the young silly ones. I hate to see any poison. I hate to see spraying Roundup. I hate to see diesel trucks start up, because when they start up, they blow out diesel fumes, which someone said is the highest form of perhaps the cause of cancer of anything, diesel fumes. But we're all driving them, aren't we? So that's my argument, is that with the 1080, no, I hate all poisons, and I'd love to see it stop. But how else can you control these bloody possums and rats and ferrets? How can you do that? Anyway, that's my opinion of that.
And the 1080 issue comes up on the show all the time, and it's a one of contention, you can promise you on that. I did want to talk to you about when the meat hunting was finally stopped and what the story was there, you know, when they finally said that you couldn't take wild meat in, or they made it so hard that people didn't do it anymore. What actually happened there? What was the opinion or the feeling of people when that went on?
I think tuberculosis was probably the main reason. They were scared of tuberculosis hitting the world market. And that's why they did. They never actually stopped meat hunting per se, but it became a regulation. You couldn't sell the stuff unless it was pre-kill inspection, anti-mortem inspection, which we have to do with the farm deer. So when the farm deer came along and the numbers came on the market, while the deer were still in the forest, they weren't in there to the degree that there were prior meat hunting. But then along came the live capture of the deer for all the farms, you see. So that probably took a toll on the meat hunting side of it. Guys like you and I, like instead of you going out this weekend and shooting a stag and getting $300 for it, you got nothing because they weren't taking it. And so there was probably good and bad things there, because they gave the deer in the bush a chance to recover, but they did start it up again, didn't they, later on? But the deer farming thing absorbed every spare animal that was available in the bush. It took everything, and God knows that they brought a lot of them here in the early days, seeker deer too. But so I guess that you'd have to say that the reason for that was the deer farming appetite for wild caught deer.
Now you've done some, or you've taken some interesting people hunting as well, haven't you, over the years? We'll sort of jump forward a little bit, and what's your experience? I personally choose not to guide. I think that it would, I just don't think I would, I'm not into it. My hunting is my time and I don't want to do it for a job. I do this as enough, you know. Tell me some of the best experiences you've had maybe doing that, taking people hunting, whether that's professionally or just taking a mate with you or socially.
Yeah, I've always believed, Steve, that there's no fun going hunting on your own. A lot of guys are loners, and I've got a grandson that likes to hunt on his own, or just him and my other grandson who works here, but it's not my style, because all the fun I've had in the bush has been with other guys, you know. God, I remember one night we rode into this place and on the horses, and we got in there, and it was a lovely fine afternoon, and we set up our camp, and then actually shot a deer the night before, and there's the antlers there. Just a little 10-pointer, but anyway, he was roaring his guts off, and he came running up the hill, and I shot him at about 2 meters off the back of the horse, that fellow there. Yeah, I often wonder why I shot it, because he should have been left to breed, shouldn't he? Anyway, so we got camped, and we looked up, and hello, what are those clouds up there? And next thing, it started to rain. I've never seen rain like it. I had horse covers for the horses, and we soon took that off them and put it over ourselves, because we were getting really wet. But that was a wonderful night, because we laughed all the way through it, and tried to sleep, and you couldn't, you know, you can't sleep when it was torrential rain like that. And so those are the sort of experiences that you get with other guys, and oh, look at that, you know, look at that deer over there. Jesus, isn't he a beauty? You know, if you come home and tell someone, I tell you, oh, Christ, I was out last night and I saw this magnificent stag. You'd think, oh, bullshit, he's probably only 8-pointer or something. But if you've got a mate there, he can verify that, you know, and they can say, well, you know, oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a great night, you know what I mean? That, to me, was what hunting was all about. It was a lot of fun, you know, looking at sign and stuff like that. But famous guys. Well, we took Burt Reynolds out one night. You remember the movie star? We took him out one night, and we got him a deer, and he was a great guy. We had a lot of fun with Burt. He always said he was coming back, but of course they never do, you know. He was a great guy. But no, just, you can go on forever about, you know, fellows you've been out with, but We've had some wonderful times up Mount Tararua. We saw 9 stags up there one night, and we were camped up there, and we just got out of bed in the morning. There was 9 stags about 300 metres away from me, and there's the head off it up there on the third from the left. See, just a mongrel head, but it's the fun of being there, isn't it, Steve? And it's no fun on your own, mate. I can tell you that.
It's interesting. I went hunting, I think I was just telling you off here, I went hunting the other night by myself, and I don't do it very often. I went out, I needed just to chill out and clear my head and all that kind of stuff. But you're right, I always harp on, and listeners right now will be rolling their eyes, because I always talk about hunting as who you're with and where you are. And where you are is one of the most important things. Yeah. And have you ever, I've always found it hard recapturing that, you know, you take photos, we've all got these phones with us now and flash cameras, and I always look back on the photos and go, that's not as good as it was, you know, that looks an amazing photo, that's a lovely picture, but to be there and feel the, I don't know if you call it the energy and the place and the whole thing is hard to recapture. Have you ever been successful in that? Because I know you're an artist, and I know that you're all about that, but have you ever been able to recapture what you see in the hills in a way that has satisfied you, I suppose, because I personally haven't.
And I'm the same. I haven't either. And I wish I'd had a camera. Can I just bore you with one little short story? I had I've got a brother-in-law. Him and I used to hunt together a lot. He was a great guy. He's since died. He shouldn't have done. He was too early. But anyway, he was a great guy, and he was shepherding at Rirafukaitu. Do you know where that is? Rirafukaitu, and it was in the days of the big numbers of deer around. So he said to me, I know this great place. He said, we'll get up early and we'll get down there, and we'll look over the hill, and I'll bet there'd be some deer there. So we did that, and we got up over the hill, and we lost count at about 50. They were just on the paddock, they were everywhere. So anyway, there's always a hind watching, isn't there? Funny thing that, I see that here on the deer farm. There's always one hind that'll be watching, you know, what's going on. But anyway, we were lucky because it was a misty morning, and we poked up over the ridge there, and there's all these deer. So we decided, skins are worth big money, we decided to start from the left. I said, you start from the left and I'll start from the right. So I had 10 rounds in the old 3-0, and he had the same. And we had a couple of clips. They used to hold 5, remember? And you'd push them in when you ran out of ammo. So I started from the left, and he started from the right, and I don't remember getting any. And I know he reckoned he wounded one, because after the first shot, which I missed, I think I was the first shot, they all bolted, and we never got a bloody deer, and there was over 50 there. That happened to me twice, and if I could bore you with one more. When I was working for Land and Survey, I was 15, and I actually had the 3-0 by this time. I said before I was 16, but I was a bit naughty because you weren't allowed a rifle before you were 16. But my stepfather bought me this 303 ex-army. It's a nice rifle. I've still got it. And the manager said to me, you better go down to the swamp there. The deer have eaten all the Swedes. He said, they're eating too many deer down there. Go down and have a bomb up. So I got two other guys that were builders, and we decided to go next morning, and it was a very misty morning. And as we went up on this little knob, of course, we looked down, and I don't know how many deer there was. There would have been, there must have been 70, 80, 100 deer there on this flat beside the swamp and on the Swedes. And we opened up, and virtually the same thing happened. I think one guy got one, but I know I didn't. Because I've never been a great shot, Steve. I'm a lucky hunter. I'm not a good shot. I've missed deer closer than that jukebox there. And anybody that says they haven't missed deer has never been hunting. Anyway, we opened up on these deer, and they all took off back through the swamp. And I think he, from memory, I think he got one. But it just shows you can have a lot of deer, but unless you're a crack shot. With the old open sights on a misty morning, it's not easy. So, but I've taken a lot of them since then. But that was two occasions when there's big numbers. You often think, oh, this is going to be easy, and you get nothing. But when you get one at 300 meters, sometimes you can get it down. But it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
I'd like to ask you some questions or bring you onto a topic around advice. There's a lot of hunters that listen to the show that have done a small amount of hunting. There's a lot of them, a lot. And there's guys like me that have done, for my age, done probably quite a lot, but not certainly the experience that you've had. And one thing that is interesting amongst hunters is that passing of knowledge is never done well. You know, I don't know why. It's almost like a secret society that you've got to get into. And part of this show is passing on knowledge and allowing people to get that. For someone like me who's done a good amount of hunting, and I've had some success, and I've definitely had some failures, and I've missed a couple, and had a couple of shots that are a bit legendary, and they're probably 50% luck, to be fair, but you know, I can skite about them now. What's your advice to someone like me, particularly after Seeker, because that's my mission at the moment. I've shot plenty of reds, and I'm on to the Seeker. If there was three or four tips you could give me on how to have a more successful Seeker hunt and a deer hunt in general, what would they be?
Oh, that's a tough one, Steve. A tough one, because every situation has its own rules, you know. Like you, I've never shot a real big 8-pointer. I've shot a few 8-pointers, but nothing of any consequence. And all the ones I can remember shooting Seeker, that's a tough one, man. It's a hard question. You're probably best to ask my grandsons now, because they shoot a lot of deer on modern times, but you know, like the Seeker deer, I don't know, the best Seeker stags I've ever seen, I've come across a pad and I've just got my back into a tree and I've just whistled with a shepherd's whistle, and to me, Stephen, I know you'll disagree, but to me, the advent of the automatic whistle and roaring machine is a huge step backwards, for the simple reason, you know, with the GPS, with telescopic sights, with, I know I'm old fashioned and I shouldn't be talking like this because I've got a scope too, but and I've got a game camera, but all that sort of stuff, man, it's taken the fun out of it, you know. If you get the old shepherd's whistle that you can buy, $2, and you give the old stuff, you know, and you just wait. Sooner or later, a Seeker stag will come and he'll do his rounds. Maybe he won't, but they usually have about four or five pads in an area of, say, it may be half a kilometre. You know all about it. But if you see a fresh pad with a bit of, and you can smell the urine, don't pick it up. Like we all do, smell it. Just get on your hands and knees and bend down and have a smell. If he's been there, just get your back into a tree and wait it out. You may see nothing, but if you take a good book, I don't mean a penthouse, I mean a good book on hunting or something, and just sit quietly and wait it out, because that stag will, during the day, he'll come back and inspect that pad. But apart from that, with the red deer, people say, oh, you know, when you're in on a red stag and he's roaring, what do you do? Do you keep roaring? Do you shut up? What do you do? And I've always waited till they're within perhaps 50 meters, and I just shut up and break sticks. That's what I do. Just break sticks. Or if you happen to have a bit of antler in your pocket, which you probably wouldn't have, just rub it up and down on a tree, something like that. But if roaring is their business. That's their business. They know what roars are. Sure, you can roar the odd one right up to you, you know, and they're crazy, but most stags are pretty cautious. And if you can just break sticks and just sit back, that's about the only advice I can give. But as I say, every situation has its rules, and I don't know what the rules are.
I've been told this a number of times, the biggest stags and the best stags and any species of deer don't roar or croak or anything. In fact, because that's how they got on, that's how they got to be that big, so they're not roaring, and they're the cunning ones. They're the once-in-a-lifetime shot type type animals. Have you had any of those? Those once in a lifetime, that big trophy, the one that you hope sticks around forever. And you've got a lot of pretty serious trophies in here. But can you talk to us a little bit about that? Is there that one that stands up bigger than all the others, or better, or hardest? It doesn't have to be the most, the highest Douglas score, you know.
Yeah, that's my favourite hunting story, that one. Have you seen the one inside that's mounted? I have, yeah. Well, I went out with this guy, and I'd been to this place many times in my youth, and I thought, oh, how about we go up this place and hunt these deer? He said, yeah, okay. Would you mind if I bring my two sons? They were 11 and 12. I said, no, bring them. So we went up there, and we camped. And there was no sign. There was no roars. It was the 11th of April. Nothing. No sign, no roars, no fresh marks. Nowadays, people would say, oh, Christ, there's been 1080 and there's nothing up here. And in those days, before the 1080 come, and there was no sign or anything. So I said, he said to me the next morning, we spent a very uncomfortable night on a slope, because we ran out of daylight and started to rain, and we were on this slope. We spent a very uncomfortable night. The next morning he said to me, oh, no, he said, there's nothing up here. He said, no sign, nothing, no, I'm going to head back to the truck. So he took his younger son with him, and I said, oh, well, I didn't come all this way just to go home. I'm going to carry on up this ridge. And so his other son said, oh, I want to go with Uncle Murray. He said, I want to go with Uncle Murray. So we got up there, and as I said before, there was no sign, and I gave a roar, and one answered way down the gully, and I thought, oh. Anyway, he roared again before I did, and I thought, oh, that sounds like a guy, because it wasn't a very weak sort of a roar, you know, and I thought, oh, no, that's a guy. So I said, oh, no, I'm pretty sure that's a man down there. And this kid said to me, No, he said, no, Uncle Murray, he said, I've heard them roaring in National Park, no. He said, I'm sure that's a stag. And I said, oh, so I give another roar, and he answered about three times, and I thought, oh, gee, perhaps it is, you see. So I said, well, we'll just sit here, and we'll wait, and if it's a guy, we'll have a yarn to him, you see. So anyways, we just sat there. I didn't make any more roars. And next thing, I heard this crashing coming through the trees, and I thought, oh, men don't usually make that sort of noise, you know. And he kept coming up, and next thing he walked out on this clearing we were on, and it was a magnificent red stag, and he was only the length of this building, probably about 25 meters, and I shot him, and his best head I've ever shot, and just shows you that I'd given up, you know, and I thought, nothing there. That was one of my favourite hunting stories. I know it doesn't sound much, Steve, but at the time it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Mm.
And that really does go back to what we said. It's about where you were and who you were with and the story behind it, I suppose, isn't it? It's always about that. And finally, Murray, we'll sign off on this. You've had an awesome life hunting. You're still out there doing it. I arrived today and there's trees coming down and you're a fit man. Do you think that the hunting side of it and being in the outdoors leads to that? You know, I look it around and I've never ever seen a guy in seriously ill health, you know, 6 hours or 7 hours off the track. You might see them on the ute just by the track, I suppose. Right. But has it been good for you? Is that part of it been something you've valued?
Oh, God, you know, I say to my grandsons, I say to everybody, you know, hunting is the most amazing thing, and there's a lot of deer around now, as you know, but hunting has just been a joy to me, and I look around all these antlers in here, and I think some of them are only knife handles, as you can see, but it's what an amazing life it's been chasing deer, and I don't know why it is, but the red deer brings out the best of it in us, doesn't it? A red deer, a red stag roaring in his natural environment is just something that you cannot reproduce. And I know it's not everybody's thing, and I know there's the lobby about hunting and everything, but gosh, you know, when you think about hunting, what a wonderful experience it is.
Oh, Murray, well, thank you for the interview and thank you for taking the time out of your very busy day to talk to us and our audience. And we're going to go have a look around the farm now. And thank you for that as well. And thank you for being such an icon and sharing knowledge.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners. And I hope the show goes down okay. And it's only my opinion, and I wish everybody has theirs. But no, thank you so much.
Thanks for the yarn. Now, remember, you can win that great prize from NZ Outdoor Hunting Magazine. That's a 12-month subscription with them. All you've got to do is be active with us. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we are on Instagram. I've only just started that, so it's a little bit sad at the moment. But find us on Instagram, The Hunting Show NZ, and Facebook is obviously just search The Hunting Show. Be careful out there, guys, and good hunting.
Broadcasting from an undisclosed location, from a secret hunting spot known only to him and the guy who told him about it, and possibly the guy who told the guy who told him. It's a show all about hunting in New Zealand and around the globe. This is The Hunting Show. Find The Hunting Show on Facebook and Twitter for up-to-date information on upcoming shows and topics.